Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaska in Conversation. I'm Robert Hannon. On this show, retired chemical engineer and administrator Frank Williams talks about coping with challenging times.
Mark Hamilton, you know, General Hamilton, he found out where that room was and comes charging in. He says, "How's it going?" And I said, "Well, we have this emergency response team with everybody doing their job. The cleanup crew is down there doing their job. We have the experts about how to deal with the power plant down there doing their job. Now we just have to sort of let it play out. We have temperature sensors in the dorms. We're watching those. And when they finally drop to a certain level, we'll have to make a decision about what to do and all that." He says, "Fine." And he left.
And Chris Lott is in with a segment on those challenging omnivores, bears.
Today we have in English essentially the brown one, an all-purpose term used to refer to a truly wide range of animals, from the carnivorous polar bear through six mostly omnivorous species to the herbivorous giant panda bears.
I hope you'll stick around. Every summer for the past several years, I've had the pleasure of hosting a live event Monday evenings at the University of Alaska Fairbanks called Down Memory Lane. It's hosted by UAF Summer Sessions, and it features retired UAF professors and leaders discussing their experiences and time at the school. This week, I speak with former engineering professor, dean, vice chancellor for administrative services, and director of the Arctic Region Supercomputing Center, Frank Williams. Frank enjoyed a long and distinguished career at the University of New Mexico, Albuquerque, before coming to Fairbanks. And following retirement, he has played an active role in the community, including serving and leading the board of directors at the Northern Alaska Environmental Center. I began our discussion, as I usually do, by asking about his family and early years.
I often notice that people who pursue engineering, math, science, come from a family that was oriented that way. Is that true for you?
No, not at all. My mom was a housewife, and my dad was a person that worked for General Motors in the acceptance part of it, the financing part of General Motors.
Okay. Now, I know you're also an avid birder. You're an environmentalist. Were you raised in that central Illinois in nature?
In a subtle way, in that throughout my youth, I went camping every month with the Boy Scouts, actually, which had a lot of interesting side lessons about life. But the thing that probably shaped me was that I was outdoors every month, regardless of the weather, doing something, a hike or a project outside.
Now, you graduated from Northwestern University with highest honors as a chemical engineer. What do we mean by chemical engineering, and what drew you to that discipline?
Chemical engineering means that you're engineering chemicals in a process, a chemical process.
What drew you to that discipline?
In high school, we were so lucky in our high school. There was a group of us, 10 or 12 of us kids, that just, for some reason, you know, sometimes fate just throws people together that we're all driven. And it was recognized by the teachers. And so the teachers fed back on that. And in those days, they offered things to us that were really special. And the one that I got out of that was Elaine Swenson, a spinster math teacher, who just taught me so much about math I even use today, really. And she said, "Frank, there's this chance for you to go up to Northwestern University between your junior and senior year and go to this program. It's an engineering program. Why don't you go up and do that? I can make it happen for you." I said, "Sure." And so I went I went up there, and the program was called the CHERUB program for some reason. I don't know what that was, but it means juniors, rising seniors in high school come, and we'll teach you all kinds of cool stuff about engineering. And the professor that taught us in this was the dean of engineering. And he said, "Well, in my segment of this program in the summer, I'm going to teach you about how to make instant coffee." And he drew out a chemical process. And I said, "That's cool. That is really, really cool." And he said, "By the way, chemical engineering is the hardest discipline. So if you start out in chemical engineering, you can go to any of the other engineering disciplines. It'll be easy for you. And you'll have all the prerequisite background. And I said, well, that seems like a wise thing to do. So that's what I did. That interaction that summer was formative not only in choosing chemical engineering, but it was also so broadening because there were other programs there, music and journalism and other kinds of programs. Well, anyway, it was a wonderful experience. And I've been blessed throughout my life with things happening like that, that I didn't orchestrate, but I was there at the right time in the right place. And
but also being prepared to engage at that level.
Yeah. So, yeah, you have to be ready. That's my other one is you got to do your homework. You know, you got to be ready to answer the question without having to deliberate it.
Well, Stanford, obviously a prestigious university. What directed you there? Did they have a teacher or a program that particularly interested you, Frank?
Yes. And I learned about it from a professor at Northwestern, Herman Pines, who was an old timer that was one of the basic inventors of catalysis, the whole field of accelerating chemical reactions, this change of chemicals. But anyway, Herman Pines saw me in class, and I did really well in it. And he said, huh, are you going to grad school? And I said, yeah, I'd probably like to go out on the West Coast. And he said, well, Michel Boudard is like the superstar in the catalysis field for the whole country and actually around the world, French, Belgian. He's really at the top of the field right now. Maybe you could go there. And so I wrote him. I said, hey, I was thinking about coming out there. You know, Herman said that you might need some students or like some students. And about a week and a half later, I got a letter. And he said, well, Frank, I'm so glad to hear from you. Why don't you come on out? We haven't gone through the formal admission stuff or the awarding of scholarships or anything like that. But I can assure you, you're going to get all of those. Just come on out. Being a little bit conservative, I said, well, great. You know, let me get back to you. And I actually interviewed a couple places out there. That letter made all the difference in the world.
As, again, a top flight graduate with your PhD, you went to the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Why did you choose there, Frank? What was there for you?
There's a step in between. I took a job in General Motors Research Laboratories in Warren, Michigan, because at that point they were developing catalysts for automotive exhaust. I don't know if you remember the CO and the NOx and all those kinds of things. And they didn't really know how to control them totally, and they were trying to develop better and better catalysts. That was environmentally cool. So that was a good thing to do. And they had a wish to keep their corporate profits down, so they would let me buy big expensive equipment. That's just a joke, but it's, you know, it felt like that. They gave us free license, and there were four or five of us that went there and did that kind of stuff for them at the time. What led me to Albuquerque was a basic inner feeling I wanted to be a professor. And I found that when I was driving to work in Warren, Michigan, it's a flat land, by the way, I'd see clouds off in the distance, but when I first saw them, they were mountains in my mind. And I kept thinking, that's telling me I really need to be in the mountains because these clouds aren't it. And so I wanted to find an academic position in the mountains. And I looked at the newspaper, and there was one in Albuquerque. And I said, well, that has all the conditions. And they were willing to hire me. That started it. So the attraction was I wanted to be there, and they needed a chemical engineer because it was a Department of Chemical and Nuclear Engineering at the time. And so I went there.
You wanted to be a professor. What about being a professor appealed to you or working with students?
The feedback, the chance to really affect students' ability to function and to think and do, and the desire to impress high standards on students. I never was one that liked to give grades. Earn grades, yes. Give grades, no. So I wanted to do all that, and I wanted to be part of the university atmosphere. I mean, the university atmosphere at Northwestern and Stanford was so wonderful, so embracing, and so culturally important. People from around the world were there, and some of the people way greater than me were at those places, and they had talked to me. One incident at Stanford I just got to bring up is I was working away in my laboratory in a laboratory where it required isolation and darkness because I was doing photosensitive stuff. And some guy came and knocked on the door and wanted in. And so I let this guy in. I said, excuse me, I got to do this. I'm doing this. And he says, what are you doing? And I explained to him, I was looking at the distance that the last atomic layer of a single crystal reshaped on its surface compared to the next to the last one. And it has a different composition than what's in the rest of the bulk of the alloy. And he says, well, how far out is that outer layer? And I said, well, it's about 0.3, 0.4 angstroms. He says, oh, yeah, that's what I would calculate. And I looked at the guy and I said, oh, that's Linus Pauling. It's like, holy cow. And he'd sit at a bench outside and talk to students. You know, it was like, well, anyway, I sort of projected that into, not that I was anywhere near that kind of person, but I wanted to have the chance to interact with students and do that kind of thing. And fortunately, some of the students were like that.
Now, your time in New Mexico, you became head of the department, and that carries different responsibilities, Frank. Is problem solving as an engineer different from problem solving as an administrator?
Yes. I got drawn into problem solving as an administrator, as a chairman of a department. I understood the territory there especially well. I knew the people. I knew that they were incredibly talented, diverse in what talents they brought to the department. And I asked for that position, and the dean then gave it to me. There wasn't the huge search kind of thing that goes on now. And then I found out that I could apply some of the problem-solving approach that an engineer might have to these things. It's like, think it through, guy, you know, and think it through from the other side was always one of my checkpoints. If it didn't work for them, then it can't work for me. You know, and you think through things like that. And I was also into analytics, so I'd put together chalkboards full of, well, you wrote one paper and you wrote 50 papers. Now, who gets the bigger raise? And, you wrote one paper, but you taught seven classes and this person taught three. Just, hey, that sort of balances out. What do you think? And everybody go, yeah. And when presented with it so that it was pictorial and visualizable, it wasn't just mumble jumbo stuff, people responded to that. Mm-hmm. And there was always the need to bring. And we're so lucky recruiting excellent people. Mm-hmm. And hey, if you have really excellent people, the rest of the part is easy. And the third part was actually sort of a basic philosophy is my job isn't to be the star. My job is to feed the stars, is to find ways to enable their best possible outcomes.
You were there almost 20 years, weren't you?
14 years.
But you came up to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and it didn't have a chemical engineering department.
No.
So what drew you to UAF?
It was in Alaska, and it was the intellectual center of Alaska. It was a real university, and it had real faculty at it. And I thought when I came that at least I'd be a peacemaker against all the competing departments, you know, because I could say, hey, I'm not a civil engineer, you know, but if you just do an objective comparison, this is the way things should go. They have 400 students and you have two. Let me see. They actually didn't like that kind of comparison because I would dig out tons of facts. And if you want to find a way to really tick people off is you expose what's going on. But often I would find nice solutions for people that would work out.
Okay, I have to ask you, you were here during the power plant mm-hmm. explosion here on campus. For a chemical engineer, that must have been fascinating. And what was your perspective of that?
I had been vice chancellor for administrative services for a very short time. And I retained the directorship of the supercomputing center. And I was up at the supercomputing center that December day, and for some reason, a group of us were having a meeting right by one of the big windows that looks out over campus from the first floor of the Butrovich building. And I was looking around, everything was sort of cool, and I looked down to my left, and all of a sudden there was this huge amount of smoke going up in the air, and it was, whoa, up there, it looked like a bomb had gone off. And I said, whoa, that is really amazing. I wonder what the heck is going on down there. And Virginia Bedford looked over at me and said, Frank, aren't you in charge of the power plant? And I said, oh, whoa, no. Really, I mean, that's I'm not even exaggerating. And it was like, holy cow. So I quickly grabbed my coat, got in my car, and drove down there. And fire trucks were already there by then. People were running all over the place. And they were running with purpose, though. They weren't lost. And immediately assessed the situation with the key people at the power plant were obviously competently taking care of the situation. A pipe inside there, a steam pipe, had burst, just corroded and burst. It wasn't like there was a raging fire at that point, except that when it burst, then eventually the coal that was burning to produce the steam got distributed all over the place. And immediately we found out that everybody that was there was safe and sound and outside. And that was like, whoa, that's great. And the objective then is to figure out how to deal with this, and how this is before we had automatic switching to GVA and before things were super skookum like they are now. I didn't know exactly how to go about stuff, but they did. And what amazed me, besides having the right people there, was that the other people that are associated with the physical plant at the time heard about it, and they knew they were needed. And they just showed up. And they started walking the lines out from there, shutting off water, doing all the right things to do in case it didn't get repaired, in case there was no heating coming. I mean, it wasn't warm then. You know, it was 20 below. And they just showed up and started doing the right thing. It was the way Alaska was. And I still think a lot of people are in Alaska. No doubt. There's just, they know. And they do. I thought, this is all super duper. Now we got to figure out what we're going to do, what all the ramifications are of this, what's going on. And immediately I recognized, and everybody recognized, if we don't figure this out, we're going to be up a creek without a paddle, because there won't be power, there won't be heat, will the university be shut down forever, for at least for the winter. Talk about a pandemic. It was like, what's going on? There's some critical things to do. And while they were doing the mop-up of the coals and all the fire and making sure everything was sort of clean down there, I went up to the police department to see what the emergency response kinds of stuff would be, because little did I know, I'd only been on the job a little while, I'd never even toured the police department. I walked in and they said, hey Frank, we sort of got this under control. I said, what do you mean? And they took me into this back conference room where it's just like a movie. Out of the ceiling dropped telephones, and they had a round table with people that from the city and the borough and the Fort Wainwright. They were all there. Yes, this is the borough's emergency response team. Bill Schechter ran that. He had organized it. He had planned it. He said, this is like our war room for when stuff hits the fan. And they all pulled out their books about this happens, then do this. And it was all perfectly organized.
Wow.
They had buses lined up to evacuate students if it was kind of that. They had places for them to stay. It was just...
That's amazing, Frank. That's so encouraging.
Yeah.
When a plan's in place, right?
Yeah. Another story, a nice story for me, was that Mark Hamilton heard about it. And he's Mark Hamilton, you know, General Hamilton. He found out where that room was and comes charging in. He says, how's it going? And I said, well, we have this emergency response team with everybody doing their job. The cleanup crew is down there doing their job. We have the experts about how to deal with the power plant down there doing their job. Now we just have to sort of let it play out. We have temperature sensors in the dorms. We're watching those. And when they finally drop to a certain level, we'll have to make a decision about what to do and all that. He says, fine. And he left. And it's exactly what you want. It clearly showed he was a general. I mean,
he knew how to let his people do their jobs.
And he was willing to fix it if it wasn't. And one more story that's really scary to me about it was that in the plant, they got everything all cleaned up, and they had isolated the pipes and the boiler that was causing the problem, and they could fire up the oil-fired part and the two remaining coal parts, and we could survive. But in order to make that work, we had to reconnect the electric intertie system across, connection system across the campus. There's a switch there, a big copper switch. And this guy named Heflinger was the electrical engineer in charge of the power plant part, you know, that part. And he said, well, we got to close this switch if we're going to make things work. And I said, so if we close the switch and we have electricity, if we don't, what? We don't have electricity and we can't keep the campus open, we're going to have to evacuate stuff. Huh. What do you think, Bill? He says, huh. He says, you know, I've opened and closed this switch before, but when you do that, you got to make sure that there are no particles on the contacts, especially no water drops. And I said, and we just had this steam explosion, and water was everywhere. So I've cleaned this off. Yeah, I think. And if there's a water drop there, and I close that, then it'll melt the switch, and we'll be SOL for a long time, because there's no replacement switch anywhere. What do you think? I said, well, I think it's your call, but I'd encourage you to just close the switch. I think you know what you're doing. He said, okay. So we all stood there sort of foolishly in harm's way, because I think if it blew up, the switch blew up, we would
have gone with it.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe that would have been just that.
A Viking funeral.
Yeah. And he went over and closed the switch and everything worked and everybody went, ah. It was great. Competent people are wonderful to be around.
You mentioned people doing their job and unionization. I know that you were on the negotiating team and negotiating contracts for that. Tell me about that process from your perspective.
I first have to say I have a huge bias against inappropriate unionization.
And why is that?
Because of early experience working in a union. Actually, I was doing a job at Caterpillar Tractor, and one day I made 14 road grader axles. I mean, just welded them together. It was a summer job, and I was supposed to make 11. And so, sweaty and tired, I was walking out of the factory, and this guy came up next to me. We make 11 axles here. I know your car, and tomorrow? I said, tomorrow I'm going to make 8. He said, yeah. And I've never forgotten that.
Sure.
I never, never, ever forgotten that. In my worldview, that's not a university. A university is, today I'm going to learn all I can learn, and I'm going to teach as well as I can, stay up at night finishing a research proposal.
So what I hear you saying, Frank, is it diminishes a responsibility, but also initiative.
Yeah, in my view. I definitely think it does. And I think that it sets the culture of average, the average raise. And everybody's going to get the average raise. And it goes way back into my understanding of the way universities developed from monasteries in the old, you know, way back then. That's where learning was. Well, this is where learning and dissemination of knowledge and being a helpful organization in the whole community, the whole society that you're in, is there. So it was really hard for me to accept the vote of the faculty to unionize. I wanted to be on the team because I wanted to make sure that we didn't really make a contract that allowed mediocrity in the faculty. For their own sake and for the university's sake, I wanted the highest possible quality from the contract. And luckily, the team, the University of Alaska team, was made up of people that had the same goal. Of all the things Jim Johnson's done, that was probably his shining armor days. He was a fantastic leader of that team, and he had wonderful people, and I was just one contributor there. That we came up with a really fair, strong document. That was really gratifying, to have a document that I could live with, I mean, just with my personal background, that others could live with their background, and it was super.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with former UAF engineer and dean Frank Williams. When we return from the break, a revolution in higher education. Welcome back. I'm Robert Hannon. Let's return to my conversation with former UAF Dean Frank Williams.
Well, now the university, of course, is facing such dire financial threats to its existence that it must be a completely disturbing situation from your perspective as an administrator and negotiating contracts and whatnot. What do you see?
I see a revolution in higher education as the best possible outcome. There are worse outcomes, like it's just not going to be here. But I think there's a real need for higher education. I mean, the whole culture needs it. So it'll be here. It'll just be really quite different. It's pretty simple to think about. Oh, I came to UAF and I took Math 101 and Professor Smith taught. Well, if you do that and you go to class with Professor Smith and you get this feeling of his vigor for teaching you how calculus works, and all the students around you either don't give a darn or they're just sucking it up, you know, and wherever you fit, you see all that. That's one experience. But now, if I go to Professor Smith Math 101 and it's my computer screen, how do I know Professor Smith's at UAF? And does it matter? And I'd argue it probably doesn't all that much. I mean, the cultural experience and being on campus matters a lot to your well-being and how you learn. But as far as learning how algebra works, you know, 2x plus equals 5, what's x? You know, you have that skill set with you, but you don't have the idea of what are the general set of problems, the algebraic problems, the first order, second order algebra, how's all that work? You don't have all of that stuff. And so maybe that identity of UAF, any campus, is going to have to be redefined. And the broadening of education at different levels may be not quite so personalized, and what to me is really important. It's not a new concept to have video classes. I know for sure that in 1970, Michel Boudard was teaching catalysis by remote video from Palo Alto, California. I was the person in the back supporting all that activity, and they were selling that class to all of the chemical companies and all of the oil companies in the world. And I'm sure they made money. But it was not the Michel Boudard I knew. Are we going to have so many tele-education courses that help us get all the tools we need? You need to know algebra in order to do differential equations. Can I learn enough that way? And maybe people are going to be learning like that, picking the tools they need. They'll have more flexibility, more tools. And then this accreditation thing comes in. Well, is it really meaningful that you took that class from Johnny from Alpena Community College or from Professor Smith here? I don't know. What can you do? Can you solve this equation? Yeah. Okay. Are you excited about it? Do you know the limitations of it? Do you know? I don't know. And so there's, I think everybody in higher education is asking that question. And then how does it piece together? And what's the piece that's left for the campus or the campus identity? So, yeah, I think that's going to be a lot different in how we're going to do that.
You were directing the supercomputing center here, and of course, supercomputers are super because they massively crunch numbers.
Yeah.
So I want to turn now to what you learned from that, Frank, and what your thoughts about going forward computing in the future.
Supercomputing here and my time with it is really dear to my heart in lots of ways. And it has bazillions of lessons and more incredibly wonderful people associated with it. It also has a lot of heartaches. Let's do the fun things. The story began in October of 1995. And Jack Keane was trying to figure out some way to get me out of the way.
Now, he was a former provost.
He came to me and said, "You've been giving me all these numbers, and we have an issue with our supercomputing center right now, and you're a numbers guy, so I want you to go out there and be the director." I said some things, because we talked very frankly, and he said, no, we're going to go up there and do that. The situation is, he explained the situation to me, so we went up there, and he called the staff of 11 people at the time together and said, You know, you guys are really in some huge difficulty now. The initial funding of this is running out. We've got till January, and we're not going to have money. And I'm asking Frank to come do this. And I was there with the people, and that was the first time I'd ever seen most of the people. And they said, the biggest problem we've had is that we can't even talk to the director at the time. We don't get in touch with him. And so I just said, well, I can't promise you that I know everything about the situation you're in, but I want to see what I can do in the time I have. And I walked over to the blackboard, a conference room in Butterfield, and said, and here's my home phone number, call me anytime. And they all go, huh? and then I left. I mean, what else am I going to say? So that got me off on a good foot. And Jack was willing to go to Washington, D.C. with me to figure out some of the funding issues and put me in touch with people that made a lot of difference. And from the beginning, since I knew I had a lot to learn about supercomputing, I looked at Virginia Bedford and said, Virginia, I need you to stay at the center and work and lead and advise me at every turn. I've also been really lucky in picking people, the right people, with probably little more than a gut feeling. And it turned out to be an incredibly good choice on my part, and she turned out to be incredibly good at doing her part. And away we went. We had to negotiate, so negotiating skills. You go to one of the biggest supercomputing manufacturing company at the time in the world, and say, you know, we're sort of cash shy right now. And you go to the people down at the accounting office at UAF and say, I don't know how this contract's going to exactly play out. And went to the people that might be able to fund us, you know, can you at least give us a verbal promise that in a few months the pipe will have a little more oil in it? They said, when do you have to know? And I said, well, I'm going to work over the Christmas break, and I'll be there on the end of December. And if it comes to be the end of December and the deal doesn't look like it's going to work to me, then I'm going to actually unplug the supercomputers and we'll all go home. I don't know if I was bluffing, and they don't know if I was bluffing, and I'm glad I didn't have to make that decision. I made the decision the other way because they all came to the table and said, huh, you know, it's in our interest, everybody's interest, to make this work. At least it wasn't like forever. It's just, let's get through this, and please have enough faith in me that I'm a no-nonsense kind of guy. We're going to just be straightforward, and from now on, there's not going to be these secret little closets of he said, she said, they promised, they have money, they don't. So it stayed plugged in. People got going in their activities. I tried to absorb the stress and have people do their jobs, and there were some excellent people that have gone on all across the country doing fantastic jobs. One of the people that worked there became the director of the Supercomputing Center at UT Austin. It was an amazing place to grow people's skills and abilities to work in supercomputing and science, computational science.
Help me, Frank. You know, there's that old philosophical chestnut about different in degree but not in kind. Is a supercomputer just like my desktop computer, only much faster? Or does it really provide researchers an invaluable tool to solve problems that wouldn't be manageable in anything less than a supercomputer?
Well, the answer is both. It's different because the individual processor speeds may be similar, even if they're different by a factor of two. That's not a factor of 10,000. They're similar speeds for the actual 010101 action of a processor. But if you have more than 2 or 10 or 10,000, what matters is how fast information can go from here to there. So it's different in the way it's constructed, so it is as fast as possible for transfer of information from processor to processor. And then there's the amount of information that can be associated with each of the processors. And now we have 4 processor laptops that you can buy that have huge memory associated with the processor. That's cool. That huge memory is a tiny fraction of what a supercomputer. So it's different. And it takes different languages. Those are the core languages, and then there are other languages that we mortals get to use to talk to the core language to make things happen. And if you're really, really a supercomputer jock, you know the core languages. But a normal faculty scientist don't have to necessarily go that far. So it's different that way. And the scale is important for the kinds of problems that it can solve. So take models of global climate. Well, it's really cool. When they first came out, I'll exaggerate a little bit, they'd divide the world in northern and southern hemisphere, and they'd say, well, they interact this way. So you say, well, I want to have a little better resolution. And so you divide it. You know, we'll take east and west and north and south. And that gets a little more intricate. Well, that's not even begin to understand the scale. By the time you break it into realistic code that describes nature at a level that people believe it has it in it, you're into things that need tens of thousands of processors. It's the accumulative ability to process data that is required for, quote, supercomputers. And a spin out of that that you didn't ask, but which is still amazes me today, is, you know, when you pull up your credit card information, oh, my MasterCard says, oh, look at that, I charged $10.77, you know, for gas yesterday. And so I just showed up there, and it's a pending account, and you have all that information. How did that happen? I mean, your laptop gets bogged down when you put all your pictures, all your audios and pictures on it. I mean, you can't even sort out where stuff is. You can't remember what file you put it in. You have to have all these hierarchies and all that stuff. Can you imagine what you do for how many 300 million people in the United States, let alone the world, so that when Robert Henlon pulls up his MasterCard, it finds the file. And it doesn't find it tomorrow. It finds it right then. And you're ticked off because the limiting thing isn't them finding it. It's the transfer of the information across our slow internet connection to your house. And that's where my comment on AI is, whose intelligence was this? Who programmed that intelligence? Did the artificial intelligence program it so that it gives you the answer it wants or the answer you want? Or an answer that doesn't even connect to reality. How do you know that? How do I know as a chemical engineer that when I use one of the new models that's out, it actually describes a distillation column? How do I know that? Well, in that case, I do know because the technology's known, but how do I know about something that I don't know? So it's not something you can just hand off. There has to be a whole cadre of checks and balances and testing that it's real. The Weather Service, they don't have one model. They have multiple models, and then they run them all, and then they sort of average it and say, well, it looks like this. I mean, so it's not like there's a rigid connection between this and what's really going to happen. Hurricanes. The hurricane's going to land in Tampa. No, it's going to land in New Orleans, you know. So it's not quite the machines have taken over yet, and I think there's a place for us to figure out, us collectively to figure out how that would be.
Yeah. You seem to have an intuitive aspect to you. I'm interested, Frank, what is the balance then between your analytical side as a chemical engineer and that intuitive aspect where you even talk about sometimes picking a team member and sense that there might be a good fit there or not? Have you ever reflected on, is there a balancing act that works for you between that intuitive side and that analytical side?
Amazing that you would bring that up, because I do think about that. The intuitive side probably runs my life. The analytical side supports it. The intuitive side comes from preparation. Sometimes I don't even know I'm preparing for it, but it comes from that. And past lessons learned that sort of build who you are and makes it easy to read. I've never had one of these body language courses, but I know I read it, and I know it. And something that I think was just a gift was able to read situations different than other people do. People like to box me in as an engineer. I don't really think of myself. Well, I talk about I'm an engineer because I love to do the calculations and prove stuff and take the GVA SNAP program, and I can calculate how much sunlight comes onto a big panel and here in Fairbanks how it works and whether it's a good payout, and I can show you all the numbers of how that works. But that doesn't answer the intuitive feel that I have, that we really need to move into things like that, and the necessity of that, and what it means to the whole world to move off of climate changing activities onto less dramatically negative things. So I've been really lucky, a lot of intuitive things. And I think that's what happens from having a background. My catalysis background taught me concepts that actually used in supercomputing. It's like information transfer. I can't explain that. It just really, really did. My time at New Mexico as chair of the department, I had opportunity to take formal courses in HR that when I came here, I could just use. I mean, it was natural. It was a part of me that these are the principles that you act on. I think everybody develops that kind of sense, like fly fishermen. I'm not a fly fisherman, but I know fly fishermen, and I know that they know that, no, it's that pool over there where I want to land this fly, because you've done it a zillion times. But you don't think it through each time about why that goes. And so that's part of intuition. You could say, well, my intuition is that that's where to cast the fly. Is it intuition or is it accumulative life experience? And so a lot of my intuition is accumulated life experience, except there are times when that's not. Another fun story for me, anyway, is I'm chair of the Department of Chemical and Nuclear Engineering at the University of New Mexico. And I got there on the second day just trying to sort out papers on my desk to figure out, you know, what was left and what's valuable. And these three guys walk in suits and briefcases. And I go, excuse me? We're here from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we're here to inspect the reactor on campus. We need keys to the reactor room. And I'm going like, we have a reactor? And so I said, you know, I can't act that stupid. So what am I going to do? You know, this is all going on in a microsecond. And I said, well, sir, who the hell are you? And they said, that's exactly the right response. You need to question our authority to do that. I mean, because we don't want someone to come in here and get in there without proving who they are. And they all got out their IDs and showed all that stuff and all that. And by that time, I said, Dr. Robinson is the person that you need to see about checking out the reactor facilities here. We're really glad you're here and hope you have a great time. And I'll go down the hall and get him. You know, where did that come from? I'm not the confrontational guy like that, but I knew that I had to do something, and that seemed like the right thing to do. And if it wasn't the right thing to do, then I'd be fired, and that's all right, too. What's that old saying? You know, if you don't like it, fire me.
Yeah. Let's go on to the next big issue. When did you get your passion for the outdoors and the environment and become a birder? Was that gradually over the years, Frank? And how has that passion played out now in your retirement?
It grew over the years. The birding one is easiest to explain because my wife and her family were birders, especially her brother. He's the most fantastic ornithologist. And Judy, my wife, sort of learned it by osmosis. And then I picked it up slowly. It's like, I love to be outdoors, and birding means I'm outdoors. Cool. Okay, I'll try to identify some birds. And then it got to be really fun, and then it got to be a reason to go outdoors. And that's where I am now. Birding is a reason to be out there. And it's fun to study birds. It's fun to do science. I can do citizen science and go beyond citizen science and do meaningful help on projects bird that just happen to be bird-related. It's a way to identify. What do you do? Well, I do bird stuff. You know, and I can identify birds, and I can help you out in the field. And so that's opened a lot of positive feedback, because I'd get to go do projects that were even out on the tundra. You know, I got to be hundreds of miles from the next living person for a week, you know, all by myself. And so that's just positive feedback, and do more and more of it. And the environmental stuff actually started probably with camping, because it gave me the background to go to the mountains and realize, whoa, It is so beautiful. It's so interesting and so helpful for me in all the stressful things that I was doing through grad school. When I was at General Motors in Michigan, just outside of Detroit, Michigan, I'd drive to Colorado for my vacation, you know, and I was just heartbroken to have to drive back. You know, I knew that it was a love of being outdoors and hiking. I actually like the physical aspect. Hiking is an exercise. It's a sport that I can't play football anymore, so I can do this. And so each of those elements sort of combined. I got my competitive part because I got to climb 14,000 foot peaks in Colorado. Didn't get them all, but I did climb those and climbed them, bonded with my kids that way. I can still remember hiking with my daughter on a ridge top way up high in Colorado, and all of a sudden her hair goes like this, and I could hear the crackling. And I thought, oh, please don't kill my daughter now. It was pretty scary. But those kinds of things. And then I would be reading the Edward Abbey books. And I wasn't into the hippie environmentalist kind of thing. I was more into the deep core value of the environment. And personally, I needed a place to go sit on a rock and a place that's not been set on by a whole bunch of other people. And so my core value now is to preserve places where people can go sit on rocks and get in touch with themselves and the nature around them. And that's why my most adamant thing is wilderness, real wilderness.
Well, in that vein, my last question then is, we've seen rollbacks of EPA standards, and there seems to be a diminishment of the importance of wilderness. That must fill you with a little bit of anxiety.
Depression. It's beyond anxiety. It's just depressing. I'm really anxious. I'm really trepidatious. I'm really depressed. And I have a real hard time going beyond these actions to see a way to avoid a major change in the way the world works. A good part of me is thinking the climate change stuff is, we're beyond the tripping point. It's going to keep changing. The question is it going to keep changing and keep changing and then boom, fall apart? I don't know how you cleanse the environment. I don't know if it's possible to cleanse it and bring it back to where it was. I don't know if the people that are on the planet now would allow that to happen because of the socio-political systems that are here. I mean, it's probably just as likely that we'll blow ourselves up with some kind of pandemic, some kind of war, some kind of something's going to do that. Or we'll do it insidiously like the Romans did. We'll drink from lead cups, you know, and then we'll be dead. And that EPA action is drinking from your lead cup to me.
Let's then end on a little lighter note, I'm hoping. What's ahead for you and Judy?
You ask a really interesting question, because I've been asking that one of myself too. Well, one of my notes at home is, okay, what's the plan after the virus? You know, after we get past, there's no escaping having to deal with this. It pervades everything we do. And I sort of thought I knew the way it was going to work out before I retired. I never lived the life of, I'm going to do whatever I want, regardless of anything. I like working in organizations where I can make a contribution. So all of the backgrounds that I've had in HR and numbers and decision making, for me, decisions are pretty easy once you understand. And if you don't have every fact, I'm willing to take a leap just based on what I do know. So I like working in those kinds of organizations. And since just before retiring and into retirement, I've worked with organizations that needed a big help, that needed a parent. And I'm willing to come in. I'm old. I can play the old. I'm the old parent.
The elder.
Yeah, the elder. And this really doesn't work. And I'm now at a point where I'm really, really looking to hand stuff off. You know, get in, do what I know I can do and fix. but I don't have the desire to run something like the Northern Alaska Environmental Center. I mean, I love that place. I love what they did. The people that started that, Jim Kowalski and those people back there, they gave us the refuge, you know, and they worked it with the natives. They did the right thing, and they knew how to play power, and the world owes them a lot. But the organization is different now, and the world is hugely different now. You know, one of my favorite phrases is, we just need to buy more senators. Well, we can't afford them anymore. we have to do things differently. And we need new people to do those things the differently way. So my job is to get them tuned in. You know, it's a different world. Here's what you got to do. Here's the way to go do it. And by the way, the critical failures that were there when I joined the board are fixed. You know, we have a great path for you. And so that's really comforting. So now I'm sort of feeling around to see what other kinds of things we might do that way. Volunteering. I love volunteering up at the volunteer center in the interagency volunteer center in Coldfoot, because bazillions of people come through and ask all kinds of questions, and you get to explain it to them. And sometimes it's really, really fun, and sometimes it's really, really exasperating, but really, really fun.
Frank Williams, thank you so much for spending time with me today.
My pleasure.
When we return from the break, Chris Slott is in with a segment on bears. Last episode, I paid tribute to the recently departed writer Sherry Simpson. Chris Slott has his own salute inspired by Sherry's book, Dominion of Bears.
Sherry Simpson, who died suddenly from brain cancer last month, wasn't just one of Alaska's finest authors, but one of the finest, a writer whose deft, ruminative work simultaneously explored the wilderness around and within us. When I think of Sherry, I automatically think of her compelling portrayals of the lives and ways of ravens, wolves, and especially bears. Drawing as close to them as anyone could, her essays outlining a geography of the edges of nature, humanity, and consciousness. It struck me that I knew considerably less about the word bear than I did the sometimes shaggy, sometimes majestic creatures themselves, given all I learned from Sherry's writing, not to mention a few too close encounters over the years. And as so often happens, a common word concealed a surprising history. Bear comes to us most recently via the Old English bera, with the same meaning as today. But before that, it traces back to the Proto-Germanic, the reconstructed parent of modern German, Barrow, meaning literally the brown one. And therein lies a tale. If you were a scholar of Proto-Indo-European, I assure you they exist, you'd expect the earliest root of bear to be arcto, R-K-T-O, from which we derive Arctic through the Greek arctos, used to refer to bears, the northern regions, or Ursa Major, the latter because through the wily ways of pronunciation, Ursine shares the same root as Arctic. This branch of would-be contemporary words for bears is seen in other early languages, such as Sanskrit, whose word for bear was arkshas. But as I said before confusing you with all of that, we call them bears, not arctos or arkshas. Why? Because the Proto-Germanic tribes we can thank for English today believed that speaking an animal's name could cause it to appear. And those tribes, likely having many more run-ins with bears than the Greeks and Romans drinking and warring far to the south, well, as the aptly named Sweet Brown famously said, ain't nobody got time for that. This phenomenon of avoidant speech resulted in many names for the feared animal, including the Slavic language honey eater and the Welsh honey pig, which make good sense to me, and the slightly more mysterious Irish good calf and Lithuanian the licker. So today we have in English, essentially, the brown one, an all-purpose term used to refer to a truly wide range of animals, from the carnivorous polar bear through six mostly omnivorous species to the herbivorous giant panda bears. Humans may rightly be considered the modern apex predators, but bears were among the originals. Our sometimes fraught relationship with them evident in the history of the very name we have chosen to represent them. Sherry Simpson put this beautifully in her essay, The Bear Beside Me, remembering a time she'd been startled by a bear and chased it off. Sometimes I wonder what would have happened had surprise and fear not driven me to my feet, had I waited to see what that black bear wanted, if anything, as it stood beside me. It's a moment I return to again and again, a moment elastic with every possibility, each one snapped as soon as I stood and yelled. When I think of that bear, that bold pest, that creature of unruly appetites, that beautiful Lightfoot, the moment reaches into the long, long history between people and bears, recalling ancient reversals in which we are each sometimes predator and sometimes prey, sometimes sacrifice and sometimes revenant, sometimes noble and sometimes benighted. And again I see how that bear taught me less about what it means to be a bear and more about all the fearful, hopeful ways in which I am so helplessly human. I don't choose to remember Sherry for her untimely death. I choose instead to remember her inspirational, exhilarating writing, her mentoring of so many fine writers, and as I said to her husband, my friend and colleague of many years, her ferocity. I'm not a believer in life after death, but I do believe there can be a kind of life in death in the style of Montaigne, a realization and a fulfillment of being and energy. And although not about bears, but another favorite subject, wolves, Sherry herself put it best in the title essay of her book, The Way Winter Comes, and it makes a better closing than any I could devise. Some people draw near to wilderness into a harder but truer place. They kill animals to eat them or wear them or sell them, never looking away from what they are about to do. By acknowledging the death that arrives through their own hands, surely they secretly wonder if they can't somehow master the way death will come to them. And some people, like me, want to look. We want so much to belong to nature, to be kin to every part of its difficult beauty, but in the end we turn away. All we can do is follow the tracks, knowing that someday the wolf will circle around to us. To listen or re-listen to this or any other Cotexic Word segment, browse to cotexic.com/KUAC. But first, do your word and writing-loving self a favor and track down as much of Sherry Simpson's writing as you can, including my two favorites, her beautiful, passionate volume, Dominion of Bears, and her early collection of poetic personal essays, The Way Winter Comes.
That's it for this edition of Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm Robert Hannon. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.